But yep. I think Euripides has a ton of play. I really do.
I do too.
I think he's overlooked. I think the old ways is kind of silly, and you can probably build around it. Yep. But I like the crew, and he's great with the crew. I played him before. The changeling thing really tricked me out, and it was really tight going through like the first three turns. It was only like the last two turns where I was able to start removing some pieces and picking up a lot of those interacts because they had models that could interact while engaged.
If you're like me, you miss playing in tournaments. Well, a group of people in the Northeast had a chance to do just that, and we're going to talk to two of the people that made the podium. Adam Talbot and Josh, talk to us how they made podium. What list did they bring? What did they face? And what were some of the key decisions that determined whether they were at the top or the bottom of the heap? Stick around to the end, because in the last segment we cover a somewhat recent discussion you've been seeing on AWP centered around summoners. Do these guys think summoners are inherently overpowered? It's a good discussion. Enjoy!
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play, or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Today we're talking to the two players that made the podium for a recent in-person event in the Northeast. Now, they had enough players that felt comfortable with the safety protocols in place, and they did something that a lot of us wish we could do, and that's actually stand across the table from somebody else and play Malifaux, or in my case, lose at Malifaux. My guests today are Adam Talbot and Josh Gaida. Now, Adam's been on the show before. I'm sure you heard his Dashiell deep dive that we did, one of our more popular deep dive episodes as far as recent ones goes. So welcome back to the Third Floor, man.
All right, how you doing, Craig? Always nice to see you.
Good to see you. Now, during the Dashiell deep dive, we got your sultry-ish history of tabletop gaming. So I don't want to put us through that again, but I would like to hear about what you have been playing. So obviously you've been playing Malifaux, but if you had a chance to play anything else or hobby in general?
Yeah, I find Malifaux to be, for me at least, just largely my competitive game. So when there's not competitive events going, I tend to use that time to mingle into other games. So I've been recently playing some AOS. I did start toying around with the latest edition of 40K, and I'm not disappointed.
That's good.
It's actually, you know what I mean, it's a Games Workshop game, so it's never going to be like Malifaux. It's never going to be strictly strategic and tactical, but for what it is, it's a lot of fun. It's way more balanced than it was. And it actually takes a lot of what Malifaux is good at, which is secondary objectives and objective-based scenarios. So it's actually, the addition's good. Will they keep it that way? Who knows? I mean, the track record stands for itself. But yeah, I've been having fun with that. And I've been playing my Arcanists, and I'm going to be starting my Outcast soon. So.
Very nice. Yeah, I was just recently a guest, and by the time this comes out, that episode will come out. So a good group of guys that do a 40K podcast, and they have been malicurious. So they came across me, and they asked me to come on the show because they've heard more than a few times me levy my opinion on GW games. So I went into the Lion's Den on that one because they love 40K. But we had a real good conversation, and they kind of updated me on the most recent edition. And the one thing that they said is that it is obvious that they have been watching weird because there are some concepts that they've picked up. It was a good episode, and I'm sure that I've already told people to go check it out. But one of the things that, and I think you'll probably agree with this, Adam, until they finally stop with the you go, I go, and they finally just make some sort of alternating activations, I just don't think they're going to come into the modern rule set.
Yeah, I mean, they've done a lot to counter that. I think a lot, because a lot of the scoring now happens, you have to have something at the objective for the next turn. So it's not only that, but a lot of the units, when they interact now, with these objectives.
Interesting.
And they can't do anything else for the most part. They just have to be there. So like I said, they definitely stole a lot of things from Weird. My problem is, again, is the track record is always going to be power creep.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at Age of Sigmar, and it was pretty balanced for like maybe half a year, and then they started coming out with new armies, and new armies were always more powerful. So, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, but you know, at the same time, yeah, the models are pretty. It's fun to get there and roll a shit ton of dice and, you know, have fun with it. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's for me, the reason I don't play it anymore is I couldn't keep up with the rules. It seemed like, you know, a new book was coming out every week and every new book changed the rule sets, and I just couldn't keep up. And I don't slight anybody that plays it. It's just I just don't have time. But I'm glad that you're enjoying it, Adam. That's good. So Josh has been playing tabletop games for 4 some odd years now, and I did not know this, but Malifaux was his first tabletop game, which I've always found interesting. I've got a good buddy of mine who has the same story, and boy, talk about drinking from the fire hose right out of the gate. So Josh, welcome to the third floor.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's hear the story. You knew nothing about tabletop gaming, and then what happened?
Yeah, so I mean, I knew of you know, 40K and Warhammer stuff, but I'd never been exposed to it. And I got into the hobby through painting figures for D&D. And then having all these things lying around and wondering if, you know, is there anything else I can do with them other than, you know, play one night a week with my friends. So I saw, looking for smaller scale tabletop games, I saw the promo art of Raspbian 2E. Nice. And that was pretty much it. You know, I was hooked after that. All those ice monsters got me.
That's cool. So now, did your painting of D&D come from playing D&D and needing the figures?
Yeah, I DM a lot of sessions, and we got sick of using the cardboard figures. And so I started picking up, you know, these models, and then we got sick of them being white and gray on the table. So it's a slippery slope.
Yeah, it sure is. So when it comes to Malifaux, do you consider yourself as much a painter and hobbyist as a player, or do you think the play piece is a bigger part for you?
I would say only because I'm real lazy about my painting sometimes. The play part takes a bigger. I'm working on a 40K Grey Knights army for 40K right now.
Wow.
And it's been 6 months. I've gotten 2 figures done. I'm real proud of that.
That's a hell of a pace, Josh. So by 12th edition, you're ready to go.
Oh, yeah. They're going to be ready.
That's funny. So I'd be curious then, the next question would be, you know, you sit down and you learn Malifaux, right? You really didn't have much of a template to work from outside of, you know, maybe some of the combat, the way it's handled in D&D. What was the hardest thing to wrap your head around as far as a skirmish level, you know, competitive miniatures game?
I would say I lost a lot when I started, and I think I lost a lot because I didn't have an eye for the table and seeing, you know, the pattern of pieces moving forward and, okay, this guy's going to go over here. Obviously he's the flanking piece. Oh, here's the schemer. And that was, I mean, once I was able to develop that and be able to look at the table and at a glance say, okay, here are the pieces and here's how the puzzle fits together. That's what, you know, took me to where I am, I guess. I don't know if I'm great yet, but.
Well, you're on third floor wars. You got to be good, right? So question for you then, Josh, was it a breakthrough? Or was it just a matter of playing a ton of games?
I think it was just, yeah, I was just playing games. I spent the first 3 years coming in at the bottom and getting the wooden spoon. And then, you know, I found my love in Kirai.
Nice.
And her versatility.
She's good.
Yeah. And then, you know, I got my skills after that. I guess everything came together.
Very nice. So I guess obviously first question, Adam, how'd you finish on this event?
I finished in first, 3 wins, no losses. 23 out of 24 victory points. So,
geez, that's good. What was your diff?
Plus 13, I think, or somewhere.
Very
around
nice.
There. It must have been more than that. But I know, all I know is, I mean, they were pretty good games for the most part. A lot of the points obviously come at the end. So, yep. I don't know how it's going to finish out to the end of the game.
Sure. And how about you, Josh? How'd you finish?
I finished third.
Very nice. Very, very nice. And we couldn't just incidentally, Adam, who finished second?
My friend and clubmate, Jared Sequeira.
Yeah, Jared. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and unfortunately, Jared couldn't make it on the show. Otherwise, obviously, we would have him on here. So, Josh, the first question I want to ask you is, you know, as the idea of this event starts to come together, I mean, this was planned and executed in a world of COVID. What did that look like? Was there feelers put out? Was it a do we feel comfortable doing this, or we're going to set the date and then see how things are. Can you give me an idea of what that looks like in kind of the modern world?
Yeah. So the Jesse, the guy that put this together, was very clear at the beginning that this was going to be a COVID, you know, ready, a COVID aware event. So we're going to be at least 6 feet apart at all times, hand sanitizer on hand. Everybody wore a mask the whole time. So it was really just a matter of, okay, how bad is it going to be in that area at that point? You know, are you comfortable even going there and taking that risk? Right. But it was really well handled, I think. I mean, in my eyes, yeah.
No, Jesse's a friend of the show. He's a good guy, real good guy. And how many players did we end up with?
10 overall, I think.
That's not bad. That's not bad.
We had 10. There was a few people that ended up having to drop late. So we were looking at around like the 12, 13 mark. 14 if Jesse had to ring. But yeah, 10 for the first live play tournament in months. So I was actually pretty impressed with that.
Yeah.
And I mean, was it nice to play three different people again? I mean, what was it like, Adam?
You know, what's funny is I actually played two people. I always play because that's the way it always is.
Right.
And I got to dodge Josh again, because every time we're at an event, for some reason, we just never end up playing.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever hit in third.
No, in second edition, we used to end up playing all the time. Now, towards the end of second, when we were traveling for tournaments, we used to end up running into each other playing all the time. But in third edition, we have not played yet. So I keep dodging that bullet because Karai's dirty.
That's what always happens to me too. I feel like I travel and, you know, I usually end up with two or three NC people with me. And sure enough, first round, that's who I'm going to play.
Yeah.
And then second round, I'm always going to play Travis Wayforth. So luckily that's never going to happen again. So
yeah, what are you banished?
Well, guys, let's take a quick break. When we get back from the break, I want to talk about round one. So round one was a corner corrupted ley lines. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Noah Suderman, and my dad is a Patreon supporter of Third Floor Wars. I listen to Tabletop Talk because of the hard work and effort that Craig Shipman puts into every podcast so that his viewers can become better Malifaux players.
What is it worth to you to get this podcast on a weekly basis? Is it worth $1 a month? $5 a month? $20 a month? If you'd like to help support the work that we're doing here on Third Floor Wars, please go by our Patreon. We're at patreon.com/thirdfloorwars. There you can pledge at any level, any dollar amount. Whatever you give us will help us put out quality content on a regular basis and hopefully make tabletop gaming a little bit better for you every week. Time for a special shout out to our newest patrons. I want to thank Eloy, Robo Rotten, Jacob Suderman, Joshua Hatch, Donald Kroger, John Fox, David Gadea, Anthony Nguyen, and Alexander Moritzen. Because of you and the 100 other plus patrons, I'm able to put out quality content on a regular basis. I appreciate your support. So round one, corner corrupted ley lines. The scheme pool was a runic binding, leave your mark, let them bleed, spread them out, catch and release. So, Josh, let's start off with who you played against.
So I was playing against Jesse Ravicki, a guy that, okay, I know. He's from Connecticut, right near me.
Yep. Now, is that Cody Ravicki's brother?
It is, yep.
Yeah, Cody's a friend of the show. He does our part of our live stream RPG that we do on Twitch. Mm-hmm. Cody's a real good guy. I've not met his brother before. You're bringing what?
So into this match, and into all three matches, actually, I brought Kirai. Okay. Not having played for 6 months, I was getting real lazy and nervous about the rust, so I brought something that I knew.
And so was that a conscious decision? You're like, I'm just going to play Kirai all three rounds, or is that how it ended up?
I had something in my pocket for round two, but we changed up the strategy on that, so I ended up going with Kirai again.
And how much variability, and we're going to get into a specific list, but I'd be curious how much your list changed from round to round.
With Kirai, this time I actually ended up playing the same list all three rounds. There's not really much flex in Kirai as a list. I'm really only changing out one model, so
right,
that's just how it played out.
So let's talk about that list. What did we have for round one?
So I brought Kirai with the Whisper upgrade, and Akirio came with her. Datsuba, Chakuna Ubume, the Lost Love, a Shikome with the Grave Spirit's Touch, two Onryo, and two Seishin.
Very nice. I like that. And kind of, what's the game plan, right? So you're sitting down there. You see, and what did Mr. Ravicki bring?
So he had a Ma crew. Ma Tucket with the Lass, Trixie Belle, Big Brain Brin, a Bushwhacker, a Survivor, and two Rooster Riders with Inferiority Complex.
Now, doesn't he realize that Ma's garbage now since Gaining Grounds 1? Why would he bring Ma?
She certainly doesn't seem that way to me.
She's not garbage. I get so angry at people.
She still drives me crazy.
She's phenomenal. She's still really good. But people are silly. So give me an idea, Josh, then the game plan, right? So models haven't even hit the table yet. You're staring at across the table. You see that Ma crew. You know what crew you've got. You take a look at the five schemes. Which schemes did you pick and why?
So Ma is a big problem for me if she sticks around in her bubble, because Brin is going to be able to shut me down and then she's going to be able to put me in the ground.
Yeah.
So I decided, you know, I'm going to spread out as much as I can, try to draw them off so that I can pick them off one by one. And then, you know, turn three or four, I'll be able to push into the center and take the center.
And is there a big concern about you getting drawn into her?
I don't think so. She doesn't have much to draw me out, and the ghosts just have so much movement power and the ability to reposition that it's not much of a danger, even with Trixie.
Okay. And so what were your two picks?
So I ended up taking Leave Your Mark and Catch and Release.
Okay. Okay. And so talk to me about deployment. So models hit the table. Is there a thought process? And is it do you pretty much deploy your Karai the same way always? Or is there a variability depending on what you're looking at?
It's going to depend on what I want to do most of the time. But in corner, your options are so limited that it's really just put them up at the front. And then I ended up getting Defender this game. So I was reacting to his Ma deployment, but he put them up in the front as well. So we were just kind of facing off across the board.
And in the first turn or two, was there anything that unfolded that either took you by surprise or things pretty much go to plan?
So he dropped his Bushwhacker on one of the markers for ley lines, which had me worried because he could very easily throw somebody over there and have them toss the token, the marker to them.
Yep. The stone, right?
The stone. Yeah. And so that would have been a problem. So my first priority was removing his ability to get that easy marker and make him come to the middle.
Mm-hmm. And and what did we do?
Yeah. So luckily I can shoot a ghost or two from one corner of the board to the other corner of the board, turn one. So
that's amazing.
It's real easy to just get in people's faces. And that's kind of what I did. I had Datsuba and the Seishin walk Akirio as close to the Bushwhacker as I could get her. And then I had Karai pop out Agoria, which I threw into the middle of his crew just to keep them occupied.
Yep. Yep.
And that ended up working out pretty well.
And it's something that I don't think people realize until they actually go up against Karai is that if she doesn't kill you, she's going to just suck your AP. She can just tie stuff up and tar pit you. And, you know, you've only got so many models and so many turns. And, you know, if she's stealing an AP here, if she's taking you two turns to kill something instead of, you know, or two activations versus one activation to kill something, you're losing the battle and she's Absolutely. Wearing you down. So final score.
So this ended up going 5-2 after everything rung out. And I believe I ended up scoring 3 off of the strategy and 2 for the schemes.
Was it just the first point on the two schemes?
Yeah, it was the first point. It's real difficult to score those second points sometimes, especially when you're going up against a crew like Maz.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's a nice win. Looking back on it now, Josh, did you leave anything on the table? Is there something that you should have done different?
No, I think this game, I got real lucky in the early turns in this game. And so it was just a matter of wrapping it up and denying him the points in the end.
You became the control and it was on him to try to make up and catch up.
Yeah, tossing that Goryeo in first turn, I did their bonus action explosion, Violent Ghosts, I think it's called.
Yep.
And ended up hitting the moderate damage on 3 out of the 4 things that I hit with it. So his crew was, you know, his crew took a beating in that first turn, and it took him a while to recover. And by that point, the game had run away.
Yeah, very, very nice. So, Adam, first of all, did you bring Arcanist?
I did. I played Arcanist for the tournament.
And who'd you go up against?
I actually went up against Cody. I went up against Cody with PK. So.
Okay, Cody. Yeah,
good guy. It was an Arcanist Civil War, so.
I don't know if I knew Cody played Arcanist. I gotta
maybe
do some recasting on the RPG. So what did Cody bring? What'd you bring?
Cody brought Karis into this, which I didn't expect. I kind of expected either for him to go with a Colette maybe. But he ended up going with Karis.
He's dumb like Hoffman. Me. I brought Karis into the Levi's.
Yeah, I love Hoffman into ley lines. I love him to ley lines. My goal going into this was I wanted to go Iron Scorpius and play 3 different masters.
Nice.
And so when we got the tournament kit, we knew what the strats were in the schemes ahead of time. So Hoffman was my plan going into round 1 regardless.
And what is it about the Hoffman crew that makes him good in ley lines in your mind?
Hoffman plus fast plus core if you do it equals they can't stop you getting ley lines.
Equals points. Yeah.
So, and particularly in this pool, I ended up going with catch and release and leave your mark. And I find that a lot of the little movement tricks that Hoffman has and his crew with the 2-inch pushes here and there,
yep,
gets them out of engagement. They can drop scheme markers. They can go where they need to go. It's very durable. In my list, particularly, I bring 2 buff bots. So, there's a lot of healing involved, and I like him a lot in this, probably more than Colette, because a lot of the movement tricks are pushes and speed as opposed to places.
Right, right. And what I say about Hoffman is, as you come for the armor, you stay for the movement. I think that the movement tricks of Hoffman are really where his strength gets unlocked. So I'm completely with you. What was your final score?
8-3, 8-4.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I got 8. I want to say he got 4. I had a plan that I had going into it, and it worked. So when your plan works, generally that's when you get a score.
And let's hear the plan.
Right, so he ended up bringing Karis, a Fire Golem, Carlos, Fire Starter, Elijah, and a Fire Gammon.
Okay.
I brought Hoffman, Mechanical Attendant, the Mobile Toolkit, Corfi Duet, Hunter with Magical Training, Peacekeeper, and Howard Langston with Soulstone Cache.
So I got to tell you, Adam, I've not played Hoffman. I've not played against Hoffman yet in third. But the rumblings I hear is that the cats aren't worth it, but you brought a cat. What do you like about him?
So in particular with this matchup, knowing it was ley lines and with catch and release in the pool, especially if he's playing Karis, he has 2 models that are going to probably try and score that. It's going to be Carlos. It's going to be the Fire Starter.
Right.
Knowing where the ley lines are allows me to know where those models are going. So I can send my Hunter out with catch and release on him. He has Deadly Pursuit. So even if he, for some reason, he gets pushed away, he's just a couple inches out, I can sneak him in at the end of the turn, score the points for catch and release. They have a decent number of hitboxes. He still has armor too, and he's fast enough where once he gets that off, he can beat feet and get out of dodge and still remain safe.
So the impression I get about Hoffman is you kind of end up claiming a part of the board, right? So that ends up being the centerpiece of the Hoffman crew, and then they work around that. Is that what you found yourself doing here? Is saying, okay, you know, I'm gonna node off of Hoffman. Hoffman's gonna be controlling this area, and then, you know, we're gonna play off of that? Or are you spreading out? I mean, how are you handling this situation?
So because I had Leave Your Mark, my plan was to have Hoffman, Peacekeeper, Howard Langston, and the 2 buff bots. They were gonna control the center of the board.
Yeah.
Not much is going to get through that. Between the healing there, between the buffs there, the focus, the power stones, 2 big beaters, Howard Langston with the soul stone, cache, letting him get those triggers. It's a solid core that can hold the center. I have 2 fast scheme runny models in the Corfi Duet and the Hunter. Both of those can take out any scheme runners they're sending at them.
Right.
So my goal was to split those out to both flanks. Have the Hunter chase around either Carlos or the Fire Starter to get the catch and release. Have the Core Free Duet just scoring ley lines, because every turn it can score it, just between fast and splitting and shenanigans, and just hold the center. And that's what ended up happening.
So, you know, normally, Adam, I like to find out, you know, what you would have changed, but you scored 8 points, you won the game. So I'd be more curious to know, what advice did you or would you give Cody? So what is there something Cody could have done that would have made your life a lot harder?
I think if he would have tried to either take out one of my flanking models, either the hunter or try to jam up the duet. I know it's tough, but because they can just walk out of combat.
Yeah.
But ultimately, if you can just block him from getting to that marker, that's a turn that I'm not scoring. The center was tough because he brought the fire golem into the center, and I spiked just heavy damage with both the peacekeeper and Howard Langston to take him out. And that was really where a lot of his damage was coming from, because of the armor. The burning doesn't really affect me, so it's just plinking away at me, but I have so much healing that all the plinking in the world isn't going to do anything.
And you know, he's only going to have so much burning on that model. You're going to end up eating through it. At first, that fire golem can seem intimidating and you just can't get through him, but you start chipping away and you can end up going through. So nice win, Adam. Very, very nice. So guys, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about round two. Now, round two was originally going to be a Gaining Grounds 1 strategy, but they got a surprise, and that surprise was they used one of the Halloween strategies. So that's the first thing we're going to talk about when we get back.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Howdy friends, Greg here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all. Crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games. Check them out at CustomMeeple.com. That's with one M. Or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code Third Floor Friend, all one word, THIRDFLOORFRIEND, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats. So originally round two was going to be a public enemies round. But now, first of all, Josh, when did you find out it was going to change? Did you find out at the event, or did Jesse tip his hand earlier?
So we took a vote just before he asked us before the tournament started whether we'd want to do it. And we took a vote just before round two, and by a narrow margin. We went over to Trick or Treat. Yeah, so it was a last-minute change-ish.
So you'd already played round one?
Yeah.
Yep. Holy cow. Okay, great. So the name of that, it was something that Weird put out, I think, in one of their Wednesday releases, the Trick or Treat strategy. Can you give us an idea, Josh, what that was?
So basically, and I love this in concept, except for one part.
Okay.
You put four strategy markers on the center line spaced apart. And you have a model go up and interact with those markers in order to get a piece of candy that is specific to the marker that you're on.
Okay, so there's marker 1, 2, 3, and 4, and you collect candy 1, candy 2, candy 3, candy 4. I got it. Okay.
Right. And you score, and you can also go to the enemy leader or henchman, I think it was, and interact with them to get a fifth piece of candy.
Nice.
And you score based on how many different pieces of candy you turn in at the end of any given round. So 1, 2, 3, or 4 different pieces of candy gets you all 4 VP.
Interesting. So does that mean each round you need to then interact again with those markers to collect
to get
up
more candy?
Oh, yeah. Okay. And that's interesting.
right? It's cool, except there's a 50-50 card flip where you can either get a piece of candy as a treat or you get tricked and gain distracted plus one on that model.
Yeah, that's fun, but it's not competitive. I get
that. Yeah, that's that was a bummer, and it affected more than one match it decided the outcome of. So
yeah, but I tell you what, as a design space, that's something it'll be interesting to see if we see something like that come up again, because I like the fact that it's all on the center line, right? So it forces the action at a very specific place. It makes standard versus flank versus corner very different with that as a concept.
Absolutely.
And I love the idea that you have to interact with different ones and the difficulty increases. That's a very interesting design space. So now you're sitting there going, okay, well, screw it. I'm just going to bring Karai again because it's what I know and I have no idea what the hell's going on here. Who did you end up playing?
So I ended up playing Jared, who would come second.
Yep. And what did Jared bring?
Originally, when this was going to be Public Enemies, I said, okay, I'm Rezzers. I need something that's tanky for Public Enemy. I have a Von Stuck built. I can play that. That would be perfect. Nice tanky crew, very killy. So I went with Kirai and Trick or Treat, and then I ended up facing a Von Stuck crew.
Oh, jeez. Well, at least you know the crew, I guess.
Yeah, I knew what was going on.
So I know I've got an idea of what your build is. I'd be curious to know what his Stuck crew looked like.
Yeah, so he took Von Stuck with the research assistant and did Anna Lovelace, the Valedictorian, two students of Viscera, and a Carrion Emissary who I think had the Whisper on it.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay. Okay. Not the list I would have brought, but that doesn't mean it's bad.
Very killy. Very intimidating to look across the table.
I bet. So what was the deployment?
So this was wedge deployment.
It was a wedge deployment.
Yeah. So and, very aggressive.
So what's the game plan, Josh, and what schemes did you end up picking?
So in my mind, I can either against this crew, I'm either going fully aggressive to try to out aggro him, or I'm just running away from him and playing defensive the whole game because he's got so many fewer models.
Right.
If I can draw one out and kill it, you know, I get a big advantage with just that one swing. I decided to go very aggressive and just try to out aggro him. And that worked kind of in my favor for the first turn. And then the game kind of fell apart into us trading models the whole time.
Now, how often was he upgrading as part of that trade? Because that's where Von Stuck can get nasty.
Yeah, he only managed to upgrade once in the entire game, which I think was probably the only reason I was able to tie it up.
I was about to say, that's a win.
Yeah.
If Von Stuck only turns one of your models into his out of five turns, that's pretty good. So you guys ended up tying.
Yep.
Okay. So looking back on it, actually, I didn't get your schemes. What were your schemes, Josh? I'm sorry.
So I ended up taking Hidden Martyrs on the two Onryo and my crew and Breakthrough.
Okay. So looking back at it, Josh, what would you have done different?
So I think I would have played a little bit less aggressively at the beginning and let him overextend because he seemed very willing to. And it's something that I should have read because he had Valley right up front and I know exactly what was going to happen when I saw that. And I had a nice little forest on my side of the board that I could have hid my guys behind and just waited for him to come in and then taken it in turn two and three. So I got a little too antsy and you know, engaged him too early.
Yeah, and we're starting to hear what I predicted a long time ago. We're starting to hear people go, oh, wow, Von Stuck is good. And I'm like, well, yeah, but anybody who read him a while ago figured that out. But the one thing that I think people are also you're starting to hear talk of is how important understanding and utilizing terrain is when you're against Von Stuck. So having you recognizing the fact that you had that a favorable terrain and leveraging that, that's where you can throw a wrench into his gears. So good for you, Josh. And you know, he's high on the curve, in my opinion. I think Von Stuck Absolutely. Is one of, if not the best keywords out there right now. Something I've argued a million times is that the distance between the best and the worst in Malifaux is very, very tight as compared to the other games we were talking about in the first segment. So it doesn't make Von Stuck unbeatable. And you've proved that because Jared's a good player. So it's not like you're against ringer or rookie playing that. So looking at what he did he leave anything on the table? Was there points that he could have or should have scored in your mind?
So I think he had, and this is the frustrating part of it, is he had an opportunity to take the game because I misplayed and allowed one of his students of Viscera to get behind my line. He ended up having breakthrough as well. I was way across the board. I was at that point out of pieces to move my guys back quickly enough to stop him. And so all he needed to do was get that 50-50 flip in one of the turns to get that one extra piece of candy. And he got distracted. And
yeah,
that's frustrating. I mean, that's frustrating for me, too, because, you know, I want to be able to battle back. And
well, it's easy to do, though, man. It's so, so easy to do. Did he put pressure on Karai or did he leave her alone?
He mostly left her alone. She stayed buried in the back for most of the game. So by the time he was able to come in on her, I really didn't care. He could waste the AP on her.
Got it. Well, that's a nice tie, Josh. How about you, Adam? Well, first off, what were your feelings about the Switch? Did you vote for the Trick or Treat or against it?
I voted for it just because it's the first time we've played in a while. We, while still wanting to remain competitive, also wanted to make it fun.
Right.
There was a difference in skill cap between some of the players. We had some newer players that were playing as well. And in my opinion, Public Enemies is just a shit strat.
It's definitely unforgiving, that's for sure.
Yeah, and it's just like you can make crews so easy your opponent can literally not score like many points, and then it becomes into a math problem. So I did vote for the change. I thought it would be a lot of fun. But that also made me change what master I was going to play in that round. So I had to start thinking.
So who were you going to bring and what did you end up bringing?
So I was originally going to bring Sandeep into this because I have a Sandeep crew that I like a lot in Public Enemies because it really trades up. And there's a ton of healing and survivability in that crew and a lot of extra activations. But I ended up taking Colette instead because the strat is largely interaction heavy.
Yep.
And also knowing what my opponent was going to play, ended up playing, made it probably the best option. So
I okay. And who'd you play and what did they bring?
I played Jake Brownell. He's a member of our gaming group, the Knights of the Round Base. He plays Neverborn, and I know he's been toying around with Lucius lately. He's also played Zoraida in the past. So I started to lean towards he's going to play Zoraida or he's going to play Lucius. I ended up taking Colette into that because I figured she would be able to counter the positives that they would put out. Yep. He ended up taking Euripides,
which actually surprised me.
It was ultimately a good pick for him. I mean, the game was really tight until the last turn or the turn before. But there's a surprisingly large amount of movement in a Euripides crew, mostly because they can jump to the pillars. Yep. Their bane being, though, that they're 50 mil bases, pretty much the entire crew.
Yep.
He brought Euripides, two changelings, Thune, two Geryon, Lyssa, primordial magic, and the Cyclops.
Nice.
Yeah, I really liked the changelings with Euripides, being able to throw out the ice pillars so he doesn't have to waste the AP on that.
Yep.
And they're just, you know, last minute scheme runners and whatever they have to do. I ended up bringing Colette, three doves, two soulstone miners, one with magical training, a Steam Arachnus Swarm with the Diesel Engine, Carlos Vasquez, and two Core of Fate, not the Duet.
Interesting. Now, Thune is the boogeyman in that crew and in that list. So I think that when you're facing Euripides' list, things are going to be built around what are you going to do about Thune. So I'd like to know what your thoughts were there.
Well, I mean, Thune, the big thing with Thune is he buries you, he turns you to an ice pillar. You have to destroy the ice pillar. I have two Soulstone Miners. They destroy terrain. Right. So I ended up going with Hidden Martyrs and picking my two Soulstone Miners because if you get rid of one, the other one can bury, turn before last, pop out, hide in the corner, whatever he has to do. I also took Vendetta, and that's the reason I started with Split Corophy.
Right.
Because then my Corophy could pick the Cyclops, combine, still keep it. And then it's almost impossible to kill a duet entirely because then they die, then they turn into a mannequin. It's just such a pain.
Yeah. Final score?
7-4.
Very nice.
7-4. It was a good game. A lot of it was played in the center, like we were talking about, but then Corphy had to actually try to figure out a way to get through his lines because he was clogging it up with Geryon and keeping the Cyclops in back. But the Corphy managed to get back there. Ultimately, I scored 3 on the strat. I scored both schemes. Big part of it was because of the 50 mil bases. I was able to, I think first turn I buried Euripides. And then the second turn I just had Colette within 3 inches of all of his stuff. And then constantly just putting out distracted like crazy. Thune couldn't hit anything because he was always at next distracted three. And then she would just, if somebody would attack her, she would bury next turn. She would drop down, poof out, distracted, and just really jammed up most of the crew.
Well, I got to tell you, Adam, I like Colette going up against him. And so when we hear talk about Euripides, and I can't wait to find people to do a deep dive. I'm still finding, try to find the people to have for that. But everybody talks about, you know, the difficulty and the frustration of having such large bases, right? So as a Euripides player, understanding and being able to master the movement with all of those large bases is key to being successful with them. What I don't think is talked about enough yet, though, is that clogs up your opponent too. It allows you as the Euripides player to really inhibit. And that's what's nice about your Colette pick, is you're not nearly as impacted by that as a lot of other crews out there would be.
Correct. That's what caused the jam up with the duet. Was the duet was running up the side. He ended up jamming with like a Gurion and like between terrain. So to go around, it was hard to get through. So inevitably, Colette had to use an AP to presto changeo, move the duet to another place, switch it with a dove, and get her out that way. But I think Euripides has a ton of play. I really do.
I do too.
I think he's overlooked. I think the old ways is kind of silly, and you can probably build around it. Yeah. But I like the crew, and he's great with the crew. I've played him before. The changeling thing really tricked me out, and it was really tight going through like the first three turns. It was only like the last two turns where I was able to start removing some pieces and picking up a lot of those interacts because I had models that could interact while engaged.
Yeah, and I think, to be honest with you, I think Euripides is similar to Colette in that it's a high skill cap, right? I think that there's definitely two layers to playing Euripides in the same way as that I feel with Colette as well. So I agree with you, and I think once people start realizing some of that second level play, the movement being a big part of it, the using those bases to your advantage, not your disadvantage, and being able to make that an asset, not a liability, I think is key. So that's very cool. So guys, let's take another break. We'll talk about the final round. We're going to talk about round three, which was not changed last minute. It was Flank and Symbols of Authority. We'll be right back.
Howdy friends, Craig here. You deserve a new playmat. Here on the third floor, we use Mats by Mars. They are scratch resistant, waterproof, wet erase marker compatible, almost free of glare, and lighter than neoprene. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. You pick a mat, pick a design, and then you pick an overlay, like one for Marvel Crisis Protocol, Star Wars Legion, or even Malifaux 3rd Edition. Those overlays will really speed up your deployment and make the placement of objective markers so easy. Use our promotion code in the show notes to get a 10% discount on your first order. In the notes of your order, you can even request the third floor logo on your mat for free. That makes the best mat in the business even a little better. So get some new mats. Save yourself some money and help support the show. Go to matsbymars.com. All the details are in the show notes, including the discount code.
So round three, we've got Adam coming in with two nice wins. We've got Josh coming in with a win and a tie. So we're going to need to see Josh make this win in order for him to make the podium. So the pressure's on there. Adam theoretically could tie or even lose and potentially still make podium. But I would assume he's probably at top table at this point. Let's talk about the pool. It's going to be Flank, Symbols of Authority, with Research Mission, Take Prisoner, Spread Them Out, Assassinate, and Claim Jump. So Adam, were you in fact at top table?
Yeah, it was myself and another one of my gaming group, the Jake Martin.
Oh, okay.
We've played several times in the past. We played actually some live games during this whole thing. He's a Rezzer player, and into almost the same matchup, he's brought Jackdaw several times, and that's what I was anticipating going into it.
Is that what you faced?
Nope. It was not.
All right. So you're thinking Jackdaw. So you decide you're going to bring.
Well, I'm thinking Jackdaw, so I'm going to bring Sandeep because I have a list where if I think I'm going into Jackdaw, I can bring Sandeep and Raspi. Right. And they gel fairly well because of the elementals. Yep. I usually bring a silent one in my Sandeep crew too. So, and she likes that matchup. So I was expecting that. I figured I'd bring Sandeep just to make sure I still had that option and that synergy would be there.
So what does he end up revealing?
He ends up bringing Reva.
Oh, actually. Wow. No kidding.
Yep. He brought Reva.
All right. So you then switch up. So what did your Sandeep list end up being without Raspi?
Yeah, I ended up not going with Raspi. I ended up doing what's something more than a little more of my standard Sandeep crew, especially into something like Symbols. I went Sandeep, Bonasuva, Kandara, because you're never going to leave home without her.
No.
Two Wind Gammon, a Silent One with Magical Training, Fire Gammon, and the Ice Golem.
Okay. And what is his Reva crew look like?
He's got Reva, the Corpse Candle, obviously, Graveyard Spirit, two Draugrs, two Lampads, and he actually took Vincent because I was playing Sandeep.
Right.
Which normally I would consider Vincent a suboptimal choice, but going into Sandeep, it's a tech piece for sure.
Yeah, I mean, he's a phenomenal tech piece. I think depending on the matchup can be great even out of keyword. But to your point, in the wrong matchup, he's garbage in keyword. Very nice. And so I'm real anxious. First, let's cut to the chase. What was the final score?
Final score was 8-2.
Oh, geez. Okay.
It was 8-2. And we've played some tight games, me and Jake. And ultimately, this game, I think, came really down to like the first two turns. He got a little forward with his Lampads, and I was able to leap with my Gammon. I was able to obey my Wind Gammon, both to walk once, and then they were able to leap beyond the Lampads, push them away from their pyre markers, and I was able to take out one of the Lampads turn one and the other one early turn two.
Yeah. Yeah, they have a hard time with defending against movement. So that makes sense. So I guess my first real question for you, Adam, is I have locked down two people who are going to do the Reva deep dive with me. They're two people whose opinion I align with, right? So I value what their thoughts on Malifaux, and both are convinced that she is competitive now, that she is the real deal now. I'd like to know, after facing her, whether you think she really jumped up hard based off of the changes.
Oh, yeah, the update definitely helped her. I've played Jake before with Reva, and if he didn't overextend those Lampads, that's a 50-50 game right down the line.
No kidding.
I think Sandeep has a little more opportunity in there because I can largely ignore the pyre markers. Kandara doesn't care, Bonasuva doesn't care, my Fire Golem benefits from them, and I can blow them up. So it does tend to go a little more Sandeep's way. Also, Sandeep's kind of silly.
He's pretty good.
Yeah, he's pretty good. But I mean, she's more than competitive. She's a very good master. I don't think Rezzers really has a terrible master. I think probably Big Morning's like the worst master in Rezzers.
Yeah, and he's not that. I mean, I agree. I think he's bottom of the heap, and he's competitive, especially in the right pool. He's competitive. But yeah, it's hard as a Rezzer player. It's hard to find a place for him right now. But I do think, unlike in 2, Rezzers are much closer to an Arcanist as far as having the choices. The one thing I've always said about Arcanists, especially in 3, is that I feel like they have some of the best internal balance that we've seen of all the factions. I think that they have very viable keywords throughout. And I think Rezzers, unlike any other time I can think of, has the same thing, to your point. Especially now, and I haven't played it yet, and I haven't played against it, but the talk I'm hearing of Reva now being viable makes it a big deal. How much of a factor was Vincent?
He ended up getting rid of my Fire Golem, but I think that was around turn 3. Yeah, he executed it, exercised it. But that was after the Fire Golem did his work. Ultimately, that's what he did. I mean, that's what you bring him for.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was worth the points because I didn't end up summoning much more after that. I generally, when I play in Sandeep, is I usually do my summoning turn 1 and turn 2. I draw a bunch of cards from the models I'm making. They turn into the big guy. They carry all the focus. And then the turns after that, I'm really using his obey abilities more. And if I do summon something, it's going to be a poison bomb and it's just dead anyway.
What do you, in your mind, what could he have done that would have made your life a little bit tougher? So if someone is listening right now and they're frustrated playing against Sandeep, what are some things that you can tell us that make things a little bit tough?
You can kill Gandara,
yeah,
because she goes a long way. Again, but the thing with Gandara is, in this particular situation, I took a research mission in Claim Jump. Research mission is a no-brainer with Sandeep. You're putting out 20 different markers all over the board just by existing. So I took research mission with him, and then I took Claim Jump with Gandara. The reason I take Claim Jump with Gandara, she can get out of engagement. She's Serene Countenance, so she's harder to hit. She's a henchman, so she can stone to prevent damage. Also bring in the Silent One, I can heal her from a distance. So I took her for the Claim Jump. But if you kill her early on, she's going to, it's going to really reduce the number of card draw I have, which is huge.
Yep. That's a big deal. Well, congratulations, Adam. That's a nice little win. big diff to finish off. That's not easy to do on a final table. So Josh, this is the pressure's on. You're looking at this, the Symbols of Authority. You've got Karai. Did you make any changes, or it's pretty much the same list?
So there's an optional change that I take for this pool, which is to remove Jacuna and stick in another Shikome just to have a little bit more speed. But I ended up not doing that because of my opponent's pick.
Okay.
So I was up against Jake for round three, and he was still playing Euripides. I don't know that he did that for game two, but and they're just such a huge crew that I thought that Jacuna could get a little bit more in there and draw them into her hazardous aura and make life miserable for a 50 mil if she stuck herself in an avenue.
Sure. So what? So we know your list. Does he have pretty much the same list Adam rattled off from round two?
Euripides, Primordial, Thune, Garion, Cyclops, three Gigants, and a Changeling.
Nice. Okay. So he still brought the Changelings in. That's a really interesting play. I kind of like that idea. I'm going to have to think about it some more. So how does this play out?
So he spawned a ton of ice pillars immediately turn one to try to block me out. He had a lot of avenues into his guys and he walled them all off very defensively. And it worked out because I think for the first three turns, it was a zero scoring game.
Wow.
We, you know, met in the middle and picked each other off and maneuvered and counter maneuvered and nothing happened.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what broke the stalemate?
So eventually we knew we had to score something. And I saw an opportunity where I could move into the center. I had Claim Jump on Dasuba. And he had left the center clear to go after some of the markers on the sides. Unfortunately, he, I think, had a misread on how Claim Jump worked and thought that I needed to have a scheme marker down in the center in order to score it. So he wasn't paying attention to that at all. And I managed to get a cheeky point there.
That's the worst.
Worst. That's a bummer. But ultimately, that's what got me the game, because the only two, the only other points that we scored were a twin research mission, 1 point for each of us, and 1 point on the strat for each of us.
Okay. All right. Very nice. So what's your big takeaway on Euripides then? I mean, you heard Adam and I talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, so he's an excellent defensive tool. And what surprised me was that Euripides is extremely mobile when he wants to be. He inched his way up, 4 inches at a time for most of the game and then vanished from just behind his center and ended up next to one of my markers to interact with it. So when he gets those ice pillars out all over the board, that becomes his playground.
Yeah. He becomes a ride the rails kind of thing. It's just kind of suddenly it's just everywhere at any point. So final score was?
It ended up 3-2.
Oh, wow. So tight game. It was low scoring. Yeah. Very nice. And so that ended up putting you into third. Adam, you got first. You guys got to play in person, which was awesome. What we're going to do, guys, we're going to take a break. When we get back from this break, I've got an opportunity here. I've got a Karai player and a Sandeep player. So we've got to talk about something that's been a bit of a buzz here in the October, November timeframe. And that's talking about summoners and whether that's a problem or not. So we'll be right back. There are so many online retailers. It can be hard to find one that is trustworthy, has great prices, along with some reliable customer service.
On the third floor, we love ordering our gaming goodies from Gadzooks Gaming. Their selection of terrain, miniatures, dice, custom decor, and conversion bits are curated for gamers by gamers. You'll find they have what you need and what you didn't know you needed to take your gaming fun to the next level. If you mention Third Floor Wars in the cart notes of your order, you'll also get a free gift. And you'll help support the podcast. Check out GadzooksGaming.com and mention Third Floor Wars on checkout to get that free gift. So it seems like once a month, there's a thread that appears on AWP that's going to end up with 175 different comments. It's going to be the big discussion. It's going to spawn three other posts. It's going to cause two episodes on podcast A and podcast B. And definitely for the fall, it was a post about summoning. And it was essentially, you know, making a case or at least presenting the argument that summoning is a problem. It presented, which I appreciated, some potential solutions. So often we see things where it just says this is a problem, then they walk away. I appreciate solutions being offered. I will tell you that the Insider Insight series that I've been doing on the podcast has made me realize that I don't know jack about designing games. And quite frankly, neither does anybody else except the people that are actually doing it. It's shocking how many people think they know what they're talking about when it comes to designing games. And it's really a small number of people that do. So I'm a little wary sometimes of people, you know, saying this is how you're going to fix it. But let's talk about it a little bit. So, Adam, I assume that you came across it. I don't know whether you listened to some of the podcasts that covered it or not. What is your initial kind of hot take when it was thrown out there?
Okay. So I think summoning at baseline is always going to be very good. You're almost always going to win the attrition game, and you are almost always going to benefit from having extra AP, because that's what wins games, is AP.
Right.
As far as being broken, I don't think that's the case. I think it's very master dependent on how powerful the summoning is.
Okay.
It's like, so like in certain instances, if your master that's summoning can summon plus, so I'm summoning plus I'm an obey master, I'm summoning plus I'm a buff master, I'm summoning plus I hit hard. If they're doing something more than summoning, it's a little more problematic. If there's card draw or any kind of other resource replenishment, it's a problem. That's why Dashiell's so strong right now. Because since the upgrade, Dashiell has card draw. He has easy access to soul stones. So there's really the negative to summoning being it's resource intensive, but then you get those resources back. It's the same with Sandeep. I can draw like 13 cards in one turn. It doesn't matter if I have to stone or if I have to like just shuffle for a card, I'm going to find it. I think that's the biggest problem in specific masters. Because like when you go to Tara, we're not seeing a lot of Tara right now.
Yep.
And she's a summoner. That's what she's supposed to be. Instead, she's really just an excellent scheme runner. Right. So it's really not summoning that's the problem. I think it's the some of the summoners might have too much resource replication and not enough reliance on those.
So Josh, in my mind, it's one thing to say summoning is good. Which Adam just said, you know, summoning strong, and there's obvious arguments to be made for that. It doesn't take a brain surgeon to understand the math behind why a summoner can be good. It's another thing to say they're broken, right? Or they're a problem is the other phrase. So I'd be curious in your mind, Josh, A, do you think they're good? I'd be surprised if you didn't, but do you think that it's a problem?
I mean, just using this tournament as an example, I was able to take Kirai into three very different pools very comfortably because of the versatility that summoning offered me. I mean, you know, that's the main reason why I can play the same list into all of these games pretty confidently. And I think that part is the problem. When you can take Dreamer into all three of your games, when you can take Dashiell into all three of your games and say, you know, even if I don't really know what my opponent is going to take, even if they know I'm going to take a summoner, it's not that much of a problem. That's a little dicey.
Yeah. Yeah. So in your mind, I mean, is Karai taking over
Rezzers then at this point? Is she just over the, I mean, if she's, you know, the best summoner in Rezzers right now, I would think, or the most effective one. I mean, I, Von Stuck is kind of, but not really. Right. I mean, what else is there? Just trying to think if there's anybody else that I would label
that. Yeah, they're really, I mean, they're the main two and Kirai is far and away the best.
Yeah.
And the part of the issue is like, what else am I going to pick? Am I hamstringing myself by taking something else? And if the answer is yes, which a lot of the time it is, then, you know, what the part of the greatness of Malifaux is this versatile space where you're supposed to have to pick your crews and pick very carefully. And when you don't need to do that, it kind of turns into a completely different game and a kind of a lesser game.
So in your mind, Josh, is there a skill cap involved here? So do you think that it's only a problem in the right hands or just inherently, you know, summoning is a problem?
I mean, it is only a problem in the right hands because there tend to be these weaknesses that can be exploited. But if you know how to get around that, then, I mean, there's not much weakness to Kirai when she can sit in the back all game and spam Goryeo.
Right.
Spam Goryeo into the other player's face. As long as you know how to prevent people from coming in on you, that's where you're stuck.
So, you know, and Adam hinted at it, you know, making resources the constraint. You want everybody that's playing Malifaux to have to make decisions, and you want them not to be easy decisions. They need to pick one or they need to pick the other. And to Adam's point, you give a summoner a bunch of card draw and suddenly one of the bigger pressures that they have on them, it kind of goes away. What are other pressures that Kirai faces specifically where you think, you know, not only, you know, obviously she needs the cards, but what else does she need? So if someone going into Kirai wants to put pressure on her, where can they find a place to put pressure on?
So in pretty much every case, I'd say pressuring the summoner themselves is going to be the way that you hit them the hardest. Because if I lose my Kirai turn one or turn two, that's a massive thing. Even if she's engaged turn one or turn two, and I have to worry about defending her, you know, keeping people around her, discarding cards to protection onto somebody else, that's going to drain my hand. That's going to occupy my mind. Like, it can often be hard to get in on summoners, but if you want to win against them and you don't have another advantage, somebody to exercise, then that's the way you're going to win.
Adam, is that how I beat Dashiell? Just go in on him?
You can, but I mean, chances are he has an executioner somewhere. You know, I think a lot of the problem with some of these summoners too, like in Karai's case, is just survivability. Like, she's not easy to get rid of. So even if you do go into her, I mean, she's probably still going to stick around. Granted, it's going to use some of her cards, but everybody has low cards that they can pitch. I think in some cases that is the way. I think in other cases, because they did a rebalancing act when they went to third edition as far as summoning and limiting the amount of sometimes you can summon, which I think was a good change.
I agree.
They also balanced it with the pass tokens, which, while, I mean, the trade-off is pretty good, give my enemy a pass token for a bunch of extra AP. I mean, it's still something. But as far as the number of times you can summon, that changed. So now the attrition game isn't automatically going to be won by the summoner. If I summon two fire gammon and turn them into a fire golem, and now you kill my golem, it's going to take a little while to get that back.
Yep.
So they did a good job with that, but it still exists where I can just constantly summon in quality AP, which becomes a problem.
So in your mind, Adam, is there something that the guys in Atlanta could potentially do as far as gaining grounds too? So is there something they could do in season two, do you think, that would lower the problem? So is there, and maybe one way to think about it, is there schemes or strategies that are already in place, like a schema approach, that being a summoner doesn't really give you the advantage, or it's just being a summoner is best in all four strats right now, and it's going to help you in all your schemes?
Well, I think they already made some changes and some fixes when they went to Gaining Grounds 1 by getting rid of a lot of those positional schemes, like Outflank, for example. There's no reason why Dashiell couldn't just summon a mounted guard, have it run over there that turn, and bam, I score it. There's nothing you can do to stop it.
Right.
I think addressing that was a big issue. but I really can't think of. I think the answer is to reduce those summoners that have unlimited access to resources and bring that down, because that's really where the problem is. It's like there's maybe 3-4 masters ultimately where they just have a bunch of card draw, they have access to soul stones, the stuff they summon in has a lot of quality AP. So if you reduce those resources, I think that brings them down the notch where they need to be.
So I'd be curious, Josh, when as a Rezzer player does Karai lose to another master? So when you're looking at a pool, what is it that you're going to see in the pool where you're going to go, you know what, I'm not going to take Karai, I'm going to take somebody else. So when does she get beat out in your mind?
Ooh. So actually, our game 3, I was up against Neverborn, and it could have been Dreamer. And Dreamer drives me crazy because he is too tanky. Too annoyingly tanky for my guys to get through. It's not, you know, the nightmares have terrifying. They are making it hard for me to hit them. They're draining my hand. That sort of thing is the thing that's going to make me question taking Karai. And it's the thing that I was most scared about going into that is, oh man, is he going to pick Dreamer? If I pick Karai and he picks Dreamer, I'm on, you know, the wrong foot. And even, you know, Pandora has terrifying stuff. Anything that's going to make it difficult for me and difficult for my models to do their job, I guess, because I'm depending on my summons.
Right.
I'm depending on my summons to get the job done. And if they can't do their jobs, if their lives are made difficult, then I don't have many ways around that. It doesn't matter if I can summon if I can't do what I want to.
So the key to counter a summoner is bring another summoner. Is that what we learned?
A key to countering a summoner is bringing something that makes their life difficult.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. No, but your terrifying point was a good point, Josh. And people have heard me talk about how good terrifying is. And especially if you are playing a keyword that doesn't handle it well. Well, gentlemen, that was excellent. Again, super envious. I've got a very small group of people that I'm able to play with in person up here on the third floor. So I have been able to sneak some games in, and it's amazing what we took for granted, being able to go into the game shop on Tuesday nights and playing. And you know, here in North Carolina, it was rare that we didn't have 2 or 3 tournaments somewhere in North Carolina to go to. And it'll make me appreciate it when it comes back. That's for sure. Josh, is there any plugs or shout outs you wanted to get out there?
I don't have anything. Nope.
All right, good. How about you, Adam?
Shout out to the Knights of the Round Base, my gaming group. Did a hell of a job. I'm proud of everybody for showing up. We're building the meta steadily as much as we can. We got a couple new players in the area.
That's great.
And check us out on Instagram at Knights of the Round Base.
Beautiful, and I'll have a link for it in the show notes. Adam, Josh, always good talking to you guys. And for those of you that stuck around to the end, thanks for listening. Take care.
Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Twitch so you don't miss the avalanche of content we create. Links are in the show notes. Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest in gaming apparel and gear. There you'll also find the latest information for the U.S. Foe Tour. Find out where you rank in your conference or even in the entire United States. Get those models built, painted, and ready so we can see you at the next U.S. Foe Tour Masters event. Please take a moment to write a review of this pod on your favorite platform. Rating and reviewing helps us find more listeners almost as cool as you are. Be sure to share this feed with all of your friends who love tabletop gaming. Thanks for listening.
Howdy folks, Craig here. Now if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with 2 measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring, along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast.
What was the name of the that strategy?
Trick or Treat.
Yep. Trick or Treat, okay.
It's a million times. It was actually supposed to be Public Enemies. Okay. But Public Enemies is a shit strat, so.
I don't disagree.
So, okay with that.
All right. What's your gin of choice, Adam?
I like Uncle Val's. Uncle Val's Botanical is really nice.
It's a very tasty gin.
It's just like I have some elderflower tonic that I mix it with and stuff, so it's just real smooth in.
You are fancy.
Yeah, but I just went over there and realized my gin was practically empty, so now I'm just doing a Tito's and tonic. So
that's good. Tito's is good, man.
My basic drink.
Tito's is good. All right, I'll bring us back. Neither of you played each other in any of these three rounds, so that didn't happen.
Nope.
So what I'll probably do is I'll start with you, Josh, if that's all right.
Sure.
All right. At Malifaux. So our guests today are Adam Talbot and Josh. I should have asked how to pronounce your last name, and I didn't.
Gaida.
Gaida. Thank you. Yeah. My guests today are Adam.
Hey, are you still here? Look, the podcast is over, and you sat through all of the breaks and bloopers? Well, I mean, if you're here, might as well run over to patreon.com and become a supporter. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast, too, while you're at it, on whatever platform you're listening to. I do appreciate you sticking around. Take care.